Do an overview and introduction to the book of Revelation here tonight. It's going to take two sessions. I can talk all night about Revelation without notes. I certainly talked about this subject many, many times before. But there's a few things we need to go over before we do an overview of the book. And that is because the book of Revelation is not like any other book in the world. I was going to say in the Bible, and that would be true. There's no other book like it in the Bible. But in the ways that it is unique in the Bible, it also is unique in the whole world of literature. For example, the book is not unique in some features, but in the combined features, it is unique. And there are three genres that the book of Revelation belongs to. There are other books in each of the genres, but there's no other book that fills all three. First of all, the book of Revelation is an epistle. Now, we don't usually think of it as an epistle. After you get past the book of Acts and read the New Testament, we read Paul's epistles, and we read James's epistle, and Peter's, and John's, and Jude. And then we come to Revelation and think we're doing something very different. Well, it is very different. Obviously, it's not like any of the other epistles, but it's like most of the books in the Bible. 22 of the 27 books of our Bible are letters written from one party to another, usually from one of the apostles to one of the churches. This one's a little different, though it is an epistle. It's an epistle from Jesus himself to seven churches. These churches were all in one area, the area today we would call Turkey. In those days, it was the Roman province of Asia Minor. In the Roman Empire, they called it Asia. And so when we think of Asia, we think of a big continent that includes China and Japan and, you know, all kinds of countries. What the Bible means when it says Asia is basically the Roman province of Asia Minor, which geographically is coextensive pretty much with modern Turkey. So these seven churches were in Turkey. They weren't the only seven churches in Turkey. We know of at least three others. Besides the seven that are listed here, there was... there's one in Troas, there's one in Hierapolis, and there's one in Colossae. All of those are also cities in that same region. For some reason, they were not included among the seven. It is generally thought that since the book of Revelation uses the number seven in a way that's broader than simply its mathematical value, because there's so many sevens in the book, if you haven't noticed, if you've read it, I'm sure you have noticed, we'll make note of that later on. But the number seven in the Bible, when it is not being used as a literal statistic, is symbolic for perfection or completeness. And so seven churches are thought by most to have been selected rather than all ten of the churches we know of in that region, because seven suggests the complete church. It would include, therefore, in some respects, a view of all churches, not only all the other ones in Asia, but all churches. At least that's how most scholars understand it. I think that's a pretty reasonable theory. But nonetheless, there were seven churches that is addressed by name to. And you can see that it's an epistle. If you look at Revelation chapter 1, and I'd like you during this introduction to be looking at the book of Revelation with me, because it's hard enough to understand when you're not looking at it. It'll be easier if you could follow along with me. But in Revelation 1:4, it says, John, to the seven churches which are in Asia. Which sounds very much like Paul to the churches in Galatia, you know. And then he says, grace to you and peace. Okay, well, that's also how epistles begin. Typically, epistles begin with just that. The author mentions his name. He mentions the persons or churches that he's writing to. He wishes them grace and peace, and then he gets into his material. So you can see that this begins like almost any other epistle. You also see in chapter 22, at the very end, it closes with the same words that most epistles, at least Paul's epistles, close with. Revelation 22 and verse 21 says, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you. Amen. Now, if you look at Paul's epistle, look at the last page of any of them, there may be one or two exceptions, but Paul's 13 epistles almost all of them end with this very line, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with you. Amen. So the book of Revelation, which is not a Pauline epistle, it's not written by Paul, yet it has the same structure as other epistles. And therefore we see that it is an epistle. It's not only an epistle. There are other epistles. Remember I said there's no other book in the world like Revelation because it fills three roles. Epistle is one of them. There are other epistles, but not like Revelation. Now, one thing we can say, knowing that Revelation is an epistle, let's say like 1 Thessalonians or 1 Corinthians or some other epistle, some things we know about epistles can be applied and should be applied. First of all, the epistles in the Bible were written to actual people living at the time. Generally speaking, every epistle Paul wrote not only is writing to people that he either knows or he knows to be contemporary with him, and they know his friends, but he's writing to them about circumstances in their churches. And so also, we should assume that the book of Revelation is written to these seven congregations in Asia Minor, and they deal with things in their churches that are going on. In fact, you can see that very clearly. When you read each of the epistles to Ephesus and Smyrna and Pergamos and so forth, each one Jesus says, I know your works, I know what you're going through, you know, he'll commend them if he can, he'll criticize them if he needs to, but he addresses things that are going on in the churches. And so like all epistles, Revelation should be thought to be relevant to the original readers and the issues in their churches. It's not first of all written to the end of the world generation. But like all epistles that we have in the Bible, we realize that even though they're initially written to people who were living at the time, they also have application beyond their own time in principle. Because, you know, if Paul writes to the Corinthians about problems they have in their church, we realize, well, we got some of those problems in our church too. And we need wisdom. We need a word from the Lord. How do you solve this problem? You've got a man in your church living in immorality. You've got disunity in the churches, people causing division. You've got people disrupting the service, speaking in tongues or whatever, you know, they're doing things. Well, Corinth had all that going on too. And we can see that Paul gives instructions what to do about those things. We approach the epistles in the Bible as primarily addressing the original readers. And whenever you study a New Testament book, you should make an effort to understand who the original readers are, what was going on in their church, what was Paul concerned about, what is he trying to correct for them. But then we realize, yeah, but we got almost all those same problems in modern churches too. And therefore we see there's transferable principles. There's applicability of what Paul says or Peter or James to the churches of his time to churches of our time too. So in a sense, they're timeless. They are time-bound in the sense that their original readers had certain circumstances that don't exist anymore in those churches. In fact, those churches don't exist anymore. Of the seven churches that are addressed in this epistle, five of them do not exist today. It's in Turkey, you know, Turkey's a Muslim country. It's not a Christian country. It once had a lot of Christians in it. But two of the churches, Smyrna and Philadelphia, happen to still have small congregations there. Smyrna is still a town. It's called Izmir in Turkey today, and there's a church there. Philadelphia has a church near it, which, you know, I don't know if it has continuity back to the 2,000 years ago, but this church is Philadelphia, or perhaps it does. Most of these churches are extinct, which means anything he predicts is going to happen to them isn't going to happen in our future. They don't exist anymore for these things to happen in their future. It's very clear the book is about first century people. And that's its first application. And we know that primarily because it is an epistle. And that's the nature of epistles. You write a letter to somebody, it's to them. If you've got a lot of wisdom in what you've written, someone else might read and say, wow, this is very profound, and I'm going to take some lessons myself in life from this. That's what we do with all the epistles. And that's what we do with Revelation. So Revelation belongs to the genre of an epistle, but not only that. Unlike any other epistles we know of anywhere, it is also a prophecy. And by a prophecy, we mean an inspired utterance that the Holy Spirit has given through an inspired person. Now, we can see that that is so Because it says in verse 3 of chapter 1, Revelation 1:3, it says, "Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and who keep those things which are written in it, for the time is near." Now, it's a letter, and Paul wrote letters, John and Peter wrote letters too, and James and Jude, but none of those are prophecies. Now, they may contain prophetic things. Paul sometimes talks about the second coming of Christ in his letters. He sometimes talks about the rapture or the resurrection or some of those kinds of things. In other words, there is prophetic information in some of these epistles that are in our Bible, but the books themselves are not prophecies. For the most part, they're just letters, and they contain different kinds of material, including, in some cases, prophecies. And so, but the book of Revelation is a prophecy and an epistle, and it's the only book in the Bible that both of those things can be said about. And we've already now eliminated all of the books outside the Bible, because only the books in the Bible could be genuine prophecies. Secular books are not. So this is why I said there's no other book in the world, not only in the Bible, but in the world, like the book of Revelation. It's an epistle and it's a prophecy. Right now we've eliminated every other book in the world. But it's a third category of things. Oh, by the way, I might say this about prophecies. Many people think of prophecies as mainly predictive about the future. And of course, the prophets in the Bible do predict things in the future. In fact, Moses and others indicated this is one way you'll know if a prophet is genuine. If he speaks about the future and it comes true, then he's a real prophet. If he speaks about the future and it doesn't come true, then he's not. So there's a sense in which prophets would give predictions in order to prove that they were real prophets. Jesus, on three occasions in the upper room, made statements to his disciples after the Last Supper saying, "I tell you these things before they happen, so that..." Now you might think, well, God tells us what's going to happen before death so we can satisfy our curiosity about the future, right? Well, very few people can say that reading the book of Revelation satisfies their curiosity. If anything, it raises more. The purpose of prophecy, even in the Old Testament, is not to satisfy curiosity. It is to give credentials to the speaker, to the prophet. When the prophecies come true, it proves he's a real prophet, and therefore the other stuff he wrote, which is most of the material in all the prophets, is not predictive. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, those prophets, they're mostly rebuking. They're mainly giving lists of sins that Israel and Judah and other nations are guilty of, and saying, this is what God's going to do if you don't repent. They're like sermons. That's what most prophets are doing. They're primarily preaching sermons punctuated by predictions. And the purpose of the predictions, generally speaking, is so that when they come to pass, you'll know that that sermon was from God, and that there wasn't just some grumpy old get-off-my-lawn kind of Jewish, angry old man ventilating his personal, gripes. He spoke from God. How do I know he spoke from God? Well, because he made this prediction, it came true. And when Jesus in the upper room said, "I tell you these things before they come to pass," he says, "so that when they do come to pass, you may know that I am he. Or so that when they do confess, you may believe." This is the kind of thing he says. In other words, I'm not telling you these things in advance so that you'll know them in advance. I'm telling you so that when they do happen, and you would know it then anyway, you'll remember that I said it. And then you'll know that everything else I said is from God, too, because only God knows the future, and I'm giving you my credentials by telling the future. John is doing that here, too. Now, by the way, most of what's in the first three chapters of Revelation is preaching. There are some predictions kind of alluded to here and there, but it's mostly just rebuking or commending or encouraging or whatever churches about what's going on in their congregations. But once you get beyond chapter 3, it's primarily predictive. So probably more than any other prophet. I don't know, maybe Daniel. Daniel doesn't do a lot of preaching. Daniel's mostly predictions, visions, and so forth, like Revelation has. There are some unusual books that have more predictive than preaching elements in them in the Old Testament, but mostly the major prophets and most of the minor prophets are primarily preaching, not focused on predicting, though there's not one of them that predicts nothing. They all have predictions, which again are their credentials. So this is a prophecy too. So it's going to preach and it's going to predict. Now, many of the prophets in the Old Testament predicted things that were long-term as well as things that were short-term. The short-term things were so that their audience would live long enough to see that this short-term prediction happened and say, oh, we should listen to this guy because he's still here and he's still preaching. It gave him short-term affirmation of who he was. But they often would look hundreds of years off, too, so that later generations that would see these things happen would know. I mean, one reason we know Jesus is the Messiah, there might be several reasons we could give, but one is that there were long-term prophecies about the Messiah in the Old Testament, which hundreds of years later were fulfilled in Jesus. So they tell us, okay, the prophets were really inspired because they were right about this, and Jesus is really the Messiah because he's the one they said it about. So again, to predict things, whether short-term or long-term, are really for primarily to prove that God is the author of this. And knowing that God is the author of it is what makes us put these books in the Bible, as instead of some other place. So the book of Revelation is an epistle. It's to the seven churches. It's a prophecy and it's an apocalypse. Now, by saying this, we're using a word that most Christians are not very familiar with. Now, the book itself in the Greek is called the Apocalypse, or Apocalypsis in the Greek. If you come from a Catholic background, and some of you probably do, you might remember in your Bible, in the Catholic Bible, the last book of the Bible is called the Apocalypse. It's this book, because that is its name in Greek. The word apocalypse means unveiling or revealing. So the apocalypse is the revelation, the revealing of something. So the Protestant Bible is usually called it the Revelation. It's equally fine to call it the Apocalypse. That's what its Greek name is. But what is that? What's an apocalypse? Well, as I said, it's an unveiling. It's removing a curtain to reveal something that was behind the curtain or under it. Now, there is a whole class of literature called apocalyptic literature that was written before the book of Revelation was written. The book of Daniel is certainly of this type. The book of Zechariah is of this type. There aren't very many Old Testament books that are strictly speaking apocalypses, but Daniel and Zechariah would be pretty much the main ones. There is some apocalyptic type material in Isaiah and Jeremiah and some other books, but generally speaking, Daniel and Zechariah are the ones that are the most like the book of Revelation in this respect. But after Zechariah and Daniel, there was a period of 400 years where there were no books of the Bible written. There were no prophets. God sent no prophets between Malachi 400 BC and John the Baptist. There was a 400-year gap and no inspired books were written. But that doesn't mean people didn't write books. It doesn't mean Jews didn't write books. It doesn't mean they didn't write religious books. The Jews wrote a lot of religious books during that time. They just weren't written by prophets. They weren't written by inspired men. They're just like, you know, you might like the works of C.S. Lewis or A.W. Tozer or, some other author you like. Good books, worth reading, but they're not scripture, okay? Because they're not written by prophets or apostles. Now, here's the thing. We know of at least 10 to 15 apocalyptic books, I'll tell you what that means in a moment, that were written in the intertestamental period. That means in that 400 years between the Old Testament's close and the New Testament's opening, 400 years, that's the intertestamental period. During that period, many, many apocalyptic works were written, and we know of at least 10 to 15. Now, I say the reason is that some portions of some books are apocalyptic and some whole books are, but there's at least 10 books like Enoch, 1st, 2nd, 3rd Enoch, 3rd and 4th Esdras, and some other books like that. The book of Jubilees, the book of the Testimony of the 12 Patriarchs, and so forth. These are the Sibylline Oracles. These are books that were written in the intertestamental period by Jews, and some of the later ones later on by Christians. And they were very much like the book of Revelation before the book of Revelation was written. They were like Daniel. They were like Zechariah. But they had the same characteristics that Revelation does. And so any first century reader of Revelation would know, oh, this is written like those books are. And they'd be right. Because apocalyptic literature has some things in common all that make it apocalyptic. First of all, most of the apocalyptic literature, Revelation's an exception, are written anonymously by someone claiming to be someone he's not. The Book of Enoch was not written by Enoch. The testimony of the 12 patriarchs were not written by the 12 patriarchs. Baruch, second Baruch, was not written by Baruch. But they have the names of these people on them because those people were actually more famous than the real authors were. The real authors do not reveal who they are, but they claim to be somebody who's more famous than they are, just either for fun or to, you might say they did it just to make their, give some kind of status to their book as if it was written by Enoch or somebody like that. But nobody believed that Enoch wrote the Book of Enoch. I think very possibly the reason for claiming to be one of these older saints or somebody is they wanted to write something from the point of view of somebody living in that era, perhaps. And so they're kind of using that as a, it's sort of like if you wrote a Civil War novel and you wrote it from the standpoint of General Grant or something like that. You know, it's like you claim to be him and you're writing a fiction. And everyone knows it's fiction, but using his name. That's what the apocalyptic books were like. Now, John wrote this one, and the reason we know that this is not a false name is because John was still living. The author would not be claiming to be John if John was still living and, you know, there. So unlike these other ones that usually choose a false author who lived hundreds of years before the book was actually written, this is accepted by virtually everyone as being written by John. The author four times claims to be John. But the apocalyptic books also have something else in common. They consist of visions and dreams in the most sensational, symbolic imagery. Most of them have an angel guiding the alleged author around and explaining things, showing him things, interpreting them for him and so forth. And there's some of that in the book of Revelation too. There's some of that in Daniel. There's some of that in Zechariah. But the thing is, the imagery is what confuses us, because we tend to read books that are written in our age as if they're more or less literal. And when we read the book of Revelation, we kind of want to find a book like that. Maybe until we find out what it says, then we hope it's not literal. But the truth is, those who focus most on the book of Revelation are those who take it the most literally. And these would be the people who are called dispensationalists. Dispensationalists, they have it's a value to them to take prophecy literally. Now, they actually feel that they occupy the higher moral ground than other Christians who don't do this, because we're taking the Bible more seriously. We take it literally, and no one else does. Everyone takes it symbolically. Now, but nobody really takes Revelation literally, even the ones who say they're doing it. 27 times, the book of Revelation describes a character who's called the Lamb. In the first description of this character, it said he's a lamb that has been slain who had seven eyes and seven horns. Now, everybody knows this is a reference to Jesus. But Jesus is not a lamb with seven eyes and seven horns. This is symbolic. Seven eyes represents seeing all or knowing all. Seven horns represents all power. These are images for omniscience and omnipotence. They're not real literal. This is how symbolism is used. And anyone says, I take the book of Revelation literally. Well, then you believe Jesus actually is a lamb with seven eyes and seven horns? The idea of these lambs is repeated 27 times or something there. So, I mean, how could it not be so? Well, it isn't so. And you know it from the first time you read it through every time you read it. He's not really a lamb we're talking about. This is a symbol for Jesus. The dragon, who's also sometimes called the serpent. By the way, a serpent and a dragon are not the same thing. But sometimes they are used interchangeably for who? For Satan. Satan is the dragon in Revelation and the serpent. He is not literally a dragon. He is literally a spirit being. But he's called the dragon. He's called the serpent. He's not a reptile. This is symbolic. The Revelation describes an animal like dictator of the world. It's called the beast. It has the mouth of a lion, the feet of a bear, the body of a leopard. It has seven heads and ten horns, and the whole world worships it, and it makes everyone worship it and obey it. Now, the dispensationalists who tell us that we need to take everything literally, not one of them believes there's going to be a quadruped carnivore animal ruling the world that has seven literal heads and ten horns. And they shouldn't, because it's not literal. In fact, in chapter 17, we're told the seven heads of the beast represent seven mountains and also seven kings. And the ten horns are ten kings. Okay, so they're not horns, they're kings. They're not heads, they're mountains, and they're kings. This is not a literal description. It is a symbolic description. And by the way, when it comes to the beast, it resembles very much the four beasts in Daniel chapter 7. Daniel had a dream where four beasts came out of the sea. The beast in Revelation 13 comes out of the sea also, by the way. Mostly lions and bears don't come out of the ocean. You know, maybe a walrus would or something, but not these kinds of carnivorous beasts. But in Daniel's vision and in Revelation, the beasts come out of the sea. In Daniel, there's four beasts, a lion, a bear, a leopard, and a beast with ten horns, interestingly enough. In Revelation, it's all of those put together. Mouth of the lion, feet of a bear, body of a leopard, seven heads, ten horns. So what he's done is he's combined all the four beasts of Daniel 7 into one conglomerate beast. By the way, they both come out of the sea. And by the way, none of them are literal animals. In Daniel, the lion is the Babylonian Empire. The bear is the Medo-Persian Empire. The leopard is the Greek Empire under Alexander the Great. And the beast with the ten horns is the Roman Empire. I don't think you'll find a Bible scholar, dispensational or otherwise, that disputes that. That's like hard to miss. In fact, most of that's explained in the book of Daniel, so you can't miss it. So the point here is, we're using symbolic stuff here. I was talking to somebody this morning about Revelation. I have a hard time believing that, you know, when a third of the ocean turns to blood and the ships sink and the islands are removed and things like that, I have a hard time believing that happened ever before. It must be, obviously, you know, something in the Great Tribulation that's coming. Well, that's because we are accustomed to seeing these things more or less literally. And if we feel like we are being more loyal to the Word of God by taking things literally that are not intended to be taken literally, that is not being loyal to it. The most loyal thing you can do to the Word of God is take it the way it was intended to be taken. Now, I mentioned Revelation is an apocalyptic book, and these features are parts of apocalypses. And we have a really good example of this from the intertestamental period, so that you'll see how this is so, how much Revelation is like the others. In this case, this is a very short example. The book of Esther, as you know, is a straightforward narrative. There's no prophecy in it. It doesn't even mention God. The book of Esther doesn't mention God. It's just a story about a Jewish girl who becomes the queen of Persia. And in the way things go, she's able to save her people from annihilation from the position she has. Nothing magical, nothing supernatural. A lot of really amazing providential stuff happens, but nothing that is supernatural or miraculous in it. And so it's just a true story about how the Jews were saved from annihilation in the days of this Persian queen, Esther, who was one of themselves. And by the way, the Jews still celebrate the Feast of Purim to celebrate that very event. Now, some anonymous Jew, after the book of Esther had been around for a while, probably 200 or 300 years afterward, some anonymous Jew living in the intertestamental period decided he's going to write an apocalyptic-style prologue to the book of Esther and also attach an apocalyptic-style epilogue to the book. And he's going to pose as Mordecai. Now, he wasn't Mordecai any more than any of the other apocalypse writers. He just chose to be Mordecai in this. And he describes himself as Mordecai having a dream. And you'll find this, actually, the Catholic Bible, which has some of the apocryphal stuff in it, they actually have these additions to Esther. Now, these additions were not written at the time that Esther was written. Esther was hundreds of years old before these additions were made by someone we don't know who it was, but he's claiming to be Mordecai, okay? Now, here's the prologue that he attached. This is before the book of Esther. At the beginning, this is attached, for example, in the Catholic Bible. This is Mordecai relating a dream that he allegedly had. Behold, noise and confusion, thunders and earthquake, tumult upon the earth. And behold, two great dragons came forward, both ready to fight. And they roared terribly. And after roaring, every nation prepared for war to fight against the nation of the righteous. And behold, a day of darkness and gloom, tribulation and distress, affliction and great tumult upon the earth. And the whole righteous nation was troubled. They feared the evils that threatened them, and they were ready to perish. Then they cried to God, and from their cry, as though from a tiny spring, there came a great river with abundant water. Light came, and the sun rose, and the lowly were exalted and consumed, those who were held in honor. That's the prologue to Esther. This is the dream that somebody claiming to be Mordecai claimed to have had. It sounds like a lost passage from the book of Revelation to me, but Revelation has not been written yet. This is hundreds of years before Revelation was written. But you can see, if you've ever read the book of Revelation, it's got many of the same features of the narrative. But what does it all mean? Well, fortunately, in this case, we know what it means because the author tells us in the epilogue. Now, we don't have in the book of Revelation or some of these other books the author telling us, here's what all this means. But in the case of this prologue, the author gives us that information. After the book of Esther, he attaches this epilogue to the book. He says, I remember the dream that I had concerning these matters. None of them has failed to be fulfilled. The tiny stream, which became a river, and there was light and the sun and abundant water, the river is Esther, whom the king married and made queen. The two dragons are Haman and myself. Haman was the bad guy in the story. Mordecai was the good guy. The nations are those that gathered to destroy the name of the Jews. And my nation, that is Israel, who cried out to God and were saved. Now, in other words, that's the story of Esther. It's just the story of the book of Esther. There were no earthquakes in the book of Esther. There were no stars falling from the sky. There were no dragons. There was no tiny spring that became a great river, and then the sun rose and all that. The book of Esther has none of those things, and yet that is the story that is described in apocalyptic terms in the prologue. Now, this is a really great thing to have possession of, especially if we're trying to understand Revelation. Because we say, okay, Revelation is written just like that prologue is, just like all apocalyptic literatures. It's got all the features of an apocalypse. And it's probably not about real dragons and beasts and monsters and lambs. It's probably about something, if you actually saw it happen, be a lot more like natural. You know? And so this is what we have to understand about Revelation. It's an epistle, it's a prophecy, and it's an apocalypse. And let me just say this. You might say, well, it's obviously an apocalypse because it's called the apocalypse. I should make this clear. The word apocalyptic literature is based on the name of the book of Revelation, Apocalypse. In other words, there wasn't a bunch of literature called apocalyptic literature, and then Revelation calls it, this is an apocalypse. In other words, it's part of it. Now, the literature existed. It didn't have a name for it. The scholars didn't have a name for apocalyptic literature. So they didn't discover it until, a long time after the church already had Revelation. These older books were found. But, since Revelation is called the Apocalypse, those books that it is known to have resembled are called apocalyptic. Okay. So there we go. Now, you should understand then that I'm going to take Revelation as non-literal. Now, a dispensationalist who believes you should take prophecy literally does not do that with the book of Daniel, does not do that with the book of Zechariah, does not do that with the book of Revelation. They'll say, there are some parts obviously absurd to take literally, but the parts that are not absurd to take literally, we take those literally. Well, wait a minute, who gave you that rule? This kind of literature is by nature non-literal. There's not some rule you apply to the other apocalyptic literature. You take it literally unless it's ridiculous. And by the way, who decides what's ridiculous? Dispensationalists tell us that the Chinese are going to dry up the River Euphrates so they can march their armies across it to invade Israel. Revelation 16. That sounds ridiculous to me. Why would the Chinese care to dry up a river? Couldn't they just send a missile? Why would they march 200 million of their soldiers at great expense to invade Israel. I don't think 200 million men could fit in Israel, for one thing. And why do it? If you want to defeat Israel, send over missiles. That's what Iran tried to do. Only China could do more. So the thing is, to my mind, it's kind of silly to think that China would dry up a river so that they could march 200 million Chinese soldiers across, who they'd have to provide provisions for and transportation, all that stuff. From China's quite a distance, by the way, to Israel. And so, you know, if China wants to, they'd fly them in, or they'd send missiles instead. This is not the way warfare is done in modern times. Besides, the drying up of the river Euphrates so the kings of the east could come resembles something else that's a main theme of Revelation. That's the fall of Babylon. Historic Babylon fell because the Persians, the kings of the east, dried up the river Euphrates and marched under the wall of Babylon and conquered it. That's the reference to drying up the river Euphrates for the kings of the east is not a reference to a future literal battle with the Chinese. This is talking about how Babylon fell. And you may remember, if you've read the book of Revelation, there's quite a few times it says, Babylon has fallen, and so forth. And the imagery of the fall of ancient Babylon is used in Revelation for this. And you'll see some other things you recognize. Like a lot of the plagues in Revelation resemble the plagues in Egypt in the book of Exodus. That's not an accident either. I'll have more to say about that in a moment. But let's talk about the date and historical setting of the book. And this is important because some people think the book was written in 96 A.D. In fact, if you have a study Bible or a modern commentary, almost certainly it'll tell you it was written in 96 A.D. That is the popular view among evangelical scholars today. John wrote this near the end of the reign of Domitian. They based this primarily on the testimony of some church fathers, beginning with Irenaeus. Now, Irenaeus was a disciple of Polycarp, who was a disciple of John, who wrote the book of Revelation. So Irenaeus is only like one generation removed from direct contact with John himself. Polycarp was a disciple of John, Irenaeus a disciple of Polycarp. And Irenaeus has a statement in one of his books which sounds like he is saying that John saw this apocalyptic vision near the end of the reign of Domitian, which would be around 96 A.D. It is this statement of Irenaeus and that of other church fathers who apparently followed Irenaeus in this that has given rise to the belief that Revelation was written around 96 A.D., and it's a very popular view. And it was not always a very popular view. Scholars used to have a different opinion in general, but they go different ways on this at different times in history. But the other view is that Revelation was written during the reign of Nero. Now, Nero killed himself in 68 A.D. So if Revelation was written in the reign of Nero, it was written before 68 A.D. Now, you might say, who cares? Who cares when it's written? I just want to know about, you know, what's happening, you know, next week in the book of Revelation. You know, is the Antichrist rising? Is there the chip in my hand now? Well, that's all I want to know. No. This is very important. Because the date of writing may actually be key to understanding what the book is talking about. Why? Because the book continually says, these are things which will shortly take place. The very opening chapter, the very opening verses. Revelation 1:1. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which he gave him to show to his servants, things which must shortly take place. And then in verse 3, we read earlier, blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of the prophecy and keep those things for certain, because the time is at hand. Now, this is written to people living in the first century. They're receiving an epistle from John, from Jesus actually, because he's the one who's dictating it. And he tells them here and repeatedly throughout the book, the time is near, this is shortly going to happen. So, of course, shortly after it was written, we have to assume. And by the way, let me show you one other verse of this type. In Revelation chapter 22, just before the book is closed, the last chapter. Revelation 22:10. He said to me, the angel speaking to John, do not seal the words of the prophecy of this book, for for the time is at hand. Okay, so the time is at hand is sort of what we're told in chapter 1. It's coming soon to a world near you. It's near, it's at hand, it's shortly going to take place. All these things are said about it. But what's interesting about this one passage, it says, do not seal the words of the book of this prophecy because the time is at hand. Well, what does the sealing of the book have anything to do with? Well, if you look at Daniel chapter 12, at the end of his apocalyptic book, he is told, you may recall, just the opposite. Daniel 12:4. Daniel told, but you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two others, etc., etc. Some people he saw, he describes them. He says, how long shall be the fulfillment of these wonders? And I heard the man, verse 7, clothed in linen, who was above the waters. And he said, times and half a time. And he also mentions again here that the time is sealed. Yeah, verse 9. He said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. Now, what Daniel is told is, seal the book because it's not going to happen right away. It's going to be fulfilled in the time of the end, and that's not now. So, until then, just seal it up. What would sealing it mean? Now, Isaiah chapter 8, he also talks about seal up his words among his disciples. Seal up the words of the prophecy. Seal up the law with my disciples, he said. What does it mean to seal up a prophetic book? It means you roll it up, you put a wax seal on it, and you stamp the date into it, or some indicator of when it was written. And you stick it away in the archives, and someday, when these things happen, you can pull out and say, oh, it was sealed on that day. Let's see, oh, it's talking about right now. These people knew this was going to happen because it's got the seal on it, of when it was sealed. Daniel is told, it's not going to happen now. It's not going to happen anytime soon. It's going to be the time in, so just seal it up. Seal it, he's told twice. John has said, don't seal this book because it's not a long way off. The time is at hand. Now, by the way, Daniel's prophecies were to be fulfilled in 490 years, 70 weeks, he's told. That was a long way off from Daniel's time. So he sealed up the book. John is told it's not a long way off, so don't. So if it was like, if Revelation would be fulfilled like 490 years after John's time, that'd be way off. He would have been told to seal it up. It must be a lot shorter time than that. In fact, probably it was short enough that these people would be affected by it. You write a letter to people and tell them these things are going to happen shortly. Probably you're implying this is something you need to know because this is going to happen, you know, to you or in your time. Something relevant to you. So, very strong suggestion that the book of Revelation is describing things that were predicted to happen soon afterward. Now remember, it's not in literal terms. But did anything happen shortly after 96 AD that in any sense could be seen as the fulfillment of Revelation? Nothing. No scholar has ever pointed to anything that happened within a century or two after 96 AD that could possibly be referred to in these prophecies. What about after 68 AD? Did anything happen after 68 AD shortly afterwards that could be described in these prophecies? Actually, something very much like it. And that was the Roman destruction of the city of Jerusalem in AD 70. The war began in 66. It went for 3.5 years. Ended in 70 AD with the destruction of the temple. The temple's never been rebuilt. This is an epoch-changing event. It was the downfall of temple Judaism altogether. A system that had been put in place by Moses, God through Moses, 1,400 years earlier, had never been canceled, but now it's canceled. Boom, it's over. Something else now. There's a new covenant now. Temple no more. And the end of the temple was the end of a 1,400-year era during which God had given the Israelites a means of worshiping him that was ordained and authorized by him. That is over now. There's a new method. Jesus said, the day is coming, woman, the Samaritan woman, when they will not worship in Jerusalem or in Samaria. Why? Because the Romans will destroy both temples. They did. He says, but those who worship God will worship him in spirit and in truth. Different kind of worship. No more sacrifices of animals. Now spiritual sacrifices. No more Aaronic priesthood. Now it's a spiritual priesthood. No more physical temple. God doesn't dwell in temples made with hands, Stephen said. But he dwells in a temple made of living stones, and that's us, built up into a spiritual house. This is what the New Testament teaches. The end of the temple, the end of Jerusalem in AD 70, was the end of an era that will never return and has been replaced once and for all with Christ himself and his kingdom. Now, that's significant. Significant enough to write a whole book about. In fact, significant enough to have a lot of prophecies about in the Bible. Jesus prophesied the destruction of Jerusalem several different times. In Luke 19, he said, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how many times I would have gathered you as a hen gathers her chicks, but now it's, you know, no more. He said, if only you had known this your day, but now it's hidden from your eyes. Now your enemies will come and they'll cast siege mounds around you. They'll knock you down. Not one stone will be left on another, he said to them in Luke 19. In Luke 21, he said, the temple will be destroyed. Not one stone will be left on another. The disciples said, when will this be? And he said, this generation will not pass before this happens. There's lots of prophecies in Jesus' teaching about the cursing of the fig tree is an emblem of it. There are several parables, the parable of the vineyard and the vineyard tenants. That's an emblem of the impending destruction of Jerusalem. It's a very major teaching of Jesus, and before him, John the Baptist, and before that, Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. In fact, in Luke 21, verse 20, when the disciples, when will the temple be destroyed so not one stone is left on the other? He said, well, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, know that its desolation is near. Then you who are in Judea flee to the mountains. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things that were written may be fulfilled. Wow, that's sweeping. Destruction of Jerusalem is going to happen so that all things that were written, where were they written? No doubt in the Old Testament. The New Testament wasn't written yet. He's saying the prophecies in the Old Testament, a lot of them, are about this. The destruction of Jerusalem is a main theme of the prophets in the Old Testament, and of Jesus and John the Baptist in the New, and, of course, of the book of Revelation, it seems to me. Now, this is what's called the preterist view. Now, I need to make clear what the preterist view is. I'm going to talk about the other views, too. And I'm not taking them in the same order that they're in your notes. But preterist is from the Latin word preter, which means past. A preterist view of prophecy is the view that a prophecy has been fulfilled in the past, as opposed to it's going to be fulfilled someday in the future. If there's a prophecy, it will either not be fulfilled, or it will be fulfilled in the future, or it's been fulfilled since it was uttered, but in a time frame that's now past for us. The preterist view holds that Revelation is written about AD 70 mainly. Now, there are people who are full preterists, which I myself consider to be heretical. Some of you may be here. Don't mean to offend you. I've written a 300-page book against full preterism. I'd say why I think it's a heresy. If you want to read the book and tell me why my book's wrong, I'll be glad to hear from you. But it's a new view. Arose in 1970-something. Like, no one was a full preterist before that. So, I mean, it's like a born-yesterday viewpoint, which denies everything the church taught for 1900 and some odd years before that. Because the church, Catholic, Protestant, Eastern Orthodox, Coptic, you name it, every church in the world throughout history said there's going to be a future, as yet unfulfilled, second coming of Christ, resurrection of the dead, new heavens, new earth. The full preterists say, no, that's all been done, all 70 AD. Jesus came back, resurrection took place, rapture took place, new heaven and new earth, it's all happened in AD 70. Now you might say, how in the world could anyone say that? I'm not going to go into that. That's their problem. They have explanations, and I take apart their explanations in my book on the subject. Why not full preterism? But full preterism is not just the view that Revelation is about AD 70, but all prophecy in the Bible was fulfilled no later than then. So that's why it's called full preterism. Preterism means prophecy fulfilled in the past. 12 preterism means all prophecy has been fulfilled in the past. The other view is partial preterism, which simply means that some prophecy was fulfilled in the past. In a sense, everybody is a partial preterist. Every Christian is anyway. Even every Jew is. Every Jew believes that ancient Babylon fell, just like Isaiah said it would, and that Tyre and Sidon and Moab and Ammon and the Philistines are extinct, just like the prophets said they would. Those are fulfilled prophecies. The Jews believe that some prophecies are fulfilled. They don't believe the Messianic prophecies are fulfilled, but Christians believe even those are fulfilled, at least hundreds of them. Christians generally say there's like hundreds of Old Testament Messianic prophecies fulfilled when Jesus came. So we believe that's, we take a preterist view. The Jews take a futurist view about the Messianic prophecies. Christians take a preterist view. They happened. When Jesus came, he fulfilled them. Now, in addition to that, there are Christians who believe Revelation and some other prophecies, like the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24, were also fulfilled in 70 AD. And that is the view that I personally hold, that most of Revelation has been fulfilled in 70 AD. Now, I'm not a full preterist. As I said, I think that's heretical. There is a future second coming of Christ. There's a future resurrection of the dead. There's a future rapture of the church. There's a future final judgment. There's a future end of the world and new heavens and new earth. The Bible teaches those things are in the future. But there are passages which we have often assumed are about the future, which I believe are not. There's prophecies that have been fulfilled, and there's prophecies that have not. The reason that we believe some of these were not fulfilled is because we have not recognized the symbolic nature of the book of Revelation. And in many cases, we say, well, there's none of this could have happened. You know, we'd have heard of this if every mountain disappeared, every island disappeared, and there were hailstones 100 pounds each, and, you know, there were locusts with tails like scorpions and mouths, teeth like lions, and yeah, I think we'd have heard about that. Wouldn't some have left a record of it? If it literally happened, almost certainly we probably would have heard of it. But I'm not arguing that that literally happened. I'm not arguing that any of the book of Revelation is intended to be taken strictly literally. This is apocalyptic literature, and it's not too difficult to figure out what it stood for when you know what happened. Just like when you read that that prologue to Esther written by pseudo-Mordecai, and you know the story of Esther, you say, oh, I see how that works in this way. You know, when you know about the fall of Jerusalem and the Jewish war, and you read Revelation, you say, oh, yeah, I can see now. I see how that fits there. But if you don't know about it, and I say I lived most of my Christian life in my younger years not knowing about it. Well, actually, now I'm old. I've actually spent most of my life knowing about it. But I began my teaching for many years not knowing what happened in 70 AD. Not having read Josephus, who was an eyewitness, and he was a historian, a Jewish historian, who was part of that war. An eyewitness of the war, and he later wrote a history of it in detail. And he was not a Christian, and he wasn't trying to connect it with Revelation or anything else. He just wrote the history. And when you read it, you say, wow, I can see that as represented here. But not if you're addicted to a super literal interpretation. Okay. So what if you are addicted to a super literal interpretation? Well, then you're going to be futurist. Futurist is the opposite of a preterist. Preter means past. Future means future. And so a futurist believes the prophecies are going to be fulfilled in the future. This is the only view of Revelation most modern American evangelicals have ever heard, even though it's the newest of all the views of Revelation. It's the most recent to arise. Well, no, full preterist is newer still. But the futurist view of Revelation is the most modern of the four main views. I've only mentioned two views so far. One is preterist, the other is futurist. There's a couple of other views that have been around longer than futurism. One is called historicism, and one is called idealism. Now, historicism is the view that was held by all the reformers. I'm looking. All the reformers were historicists. They believe Revelation gives a panorama of the whole church age, from John's day to the end of the world. and it goes through the fall of the Western Roman Empire, the fall of the Eastern Roman Empire to the Muslims, the Reformation, the French Revolution. They find all these things in Revelation as you move from John's age to modern age. And all the Reformers believe this. Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, John Knox, all the Reformers believe this. This is actually called the Protestant view of Revelation for several centuries after the Reformation, until futurism became more popular. But futurism arose pretty much in the 19th century and has become, at this point in time, the most popular view among at least American Christians, partly due to novels and movies and things that were made allegedly about Revelation, which take a futurist view. Now, I mentioned the idealist view. The idealist view is the view that Revelation is not specifically about any particular time frame, but rather it is symbolic drama that depicts spiritual truths that are always applicable. The sovereignty of God, the ongoing spiritual warfare, the victory of Christ over Satan, the vindication of Christian martyrs in heaven, that these are principles that are always true through the whole church age. They don't apply to any particular time. They don't touch down in any historical, except maybe they recur. They recur throughout history, but it's not talking about the historical events as much as the concept, the idea, the ideal. It's called idealism. There's a lot of those out there now, too. But now, that means there's four views of Revelation. When I go through it with you in a few moments, I'm going to take the view that I understand to be true. You don't have to take that view. If you get my book, I give all four views equal coverage and never give a hint, I hope, what my view is. I read a dozen commentaries on each of the four views. I read 50 commentaries writing this book. And I tried to give equal coverage and equal serious consideration to each view. Now, I'm not going to bother doing that. That takes too long here now. And I don't have much time tonight to do this, so I'm going to just tell you what I think. If you want to know the other views more, then you can read the book or listen to anybody else than me on the subject. But just want you to know, the four views of Revelation are, the preterist view holds that it was actually fulfilled shortly after it was written, and it was written in the reign of Nero. And the thing that was fulfilled in it was the Jewish war and the destruction of Jerusalem. This fits very well, not only the material in the book, as we shall see, it also fits the fact that the book begins and ends by emphatically saying, these things are going to happen soon. And so, we take the book seriously. That's taking it literally. When the author says, this is going to happen soon, we'll take that part literally. That's not in a symbolic vision. That's a statement that an angel says to John about the time frame. So preterist takes it that way. That's about that. Futurist primarily thinks it's all still future, pretty much after the rapture of the church. Dispensationalists believe the rapture of the church happens in Revelation 4:1. And after that, everything is future, tribulation, millennium, new earth. And then, of course, the historicist view kind of just stretches all of church history out through the book, chronologically. And then the idealist view just holds that it's not really about any particular event, it's about ideas that are always true. A little bit like if you've ever read Pilgrim's Progress. The story is a story. It's not a true story. No one believes it's a true story, but you recognize the guy's name is Christian. He meets a friend named Faithful who gets martyred. He faces up against worldly wise men and people have names like that. He gets trapped in Doubting Castle, and the giant Despair keeps him in prison until he finds the key of promise. This is like, it's a fascinating narrative. It's one of the greatest books ever written. Pilgrim's Progress is called. Written back in the 1600s, I believe. Anyway, it's not a true story. It's symbolic. It talks about things that are always true. It's a universal Christian experience that is symbolically depicted in the story. That's what many people think that Revelation is like. That's the idealist view. Now, I'm going to take a break here, and I'm going to go through the book with you, and I'm going to give you some other interesting stuff that you won't find in the book itself. You'll find it in my book. But stuff that you won't hear very many other places, probably. But it's valid historical stuff. Why don't we take a break right here? And we will come back in about 10 minutes, and we'll have another session if you're still here. If you're not, I'll do it anyway.